Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Corporate tax policy. I know, right? A surefire way to mess up an otherwise fine day in the American economy. The president wants to change corporate tax rates. Congress and politics aside, though, the question is what happens if he does? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 22nd of February. Good as always to have you with us. And item one, as we get going today, this is a presidential election year. Item two, tax reform is a politically difficult thing. Item three, politically difficult things don't usually get done in presidential election years, which leads inescapably to conclusion four. The president's proposed changes to the corporate tax structure in this country might better be thought of as the first steps of a negotiation, not as something that will eventually become law as is. The logic, though, goes something like this. How does this country compete with Europe, with Asia, with anybody, actually, because it seems cheaper to do business everywhere but here? So the president wants to lower taxes for American companies, especially manufacturers. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore walks us through it.
Today's official statements on corporate tax reform sounded to me like the teacher from Peanuts putting Peppermint Patty to sleep. To jolt myself awake, I pretended to be the CEO of a company, Heidi's Widgets, and asked some experts whether this new plan would save me any money. Howard Gleckman at the Tax Policy Center helped me out.
Let's say you're a very successful corporation, so you pay the top tax rate of 35%. We're going to cut it to 28%.
Score! And since I'm a manufacturer, my new tax rate could be as low as 25%.
But we're going to take away a lot of your tax breaks.
Bummer. And he told me that my taxes will go up on the money I make overseas, but the government won't tell me how much. And here I was hoping they would let me bring that money back to the States so I could hire more people.
Didn't work the last time. I'm dubious.
That's Hope Krebs. She advises companies for the law firm Duane Morris. I think she's on to me. In 2004, when Heidi's Widgets got a tax break for those overseas profits, I didn't hire anybody. Manufacturers like me always want more. Well, don't we have tax breaks in favor of manufacturing?
Yeah, we've got lots of them. Has it made a difference? No.
So I'm paying 25% and I'm losing a bunch of tax breaks. How does Heidi's Widgets stack up next to GE? Howard Gleckman told me not to expect a level playing field, even at home.
Heidi, you're never going to compete with General Electric. They have a staff of hundreds of lawyers who make sure that they pay taxes in the single digits.
It's so unfair. But that seems to be something that the tax code can never fix. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Today, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau set its sights on overdraft fees, that extra hit, something not insignificant usually, like $35 or so, that you take in the case of insufficient funds. Never happens to you, you say? Well, congratulations, you're among the vast majority that rarely or never overdraws. But we heard this statistic this morning on another public radio program that 84% of overdraft fees are racked up by just 9% of consumers. And so we got to wondering who that 9% is. Elizabeth Wynn Johnson has more now from Washington.
Does this sound familiar? You know money's tight this month, but you think you're okay. Then the bank statement arrives.
FYI, we charged you $35 or $85 this month in overdraft charges. And you would say, well, now, how is that possible?
Bart Naylor is an expert in financial regulation at the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen.
We certainly welcome the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's entry into this very nettlesome area of overdraft fees.
What exactly is so nettlesome about a penalty for promising money that's not there?
I can remember the day, and I'm old enough to remember this, when people overdrew their bank account several times would be asked to take their business elsewhere.
That's banking consultant Bert Ely. Every overdraft amounts to an unplanned loan by the bank. Fees not only compensate, they may also deter bad choices. But how are consumers making those choices? Naylor says banks bury the explanation, the fees, in 100-page contracts.
It's unclear exactly how Americans seem to go $38 billion in overdraft fees over a year when people usually are trying to be careful with their money. And so I think that's one of the important issues that the CFPB study can ascertain.
Consumer advocates say overdrafters tend to be younger and poorer. But are they reckless or just ill-informed? Ensuring that consumers know where they stand and when it's safe to write that next check is a start. In Washington, I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson for Marketplace.
This is going to sound like sacrilege to some, and please don't misunderstand, but climate change might actually turn out to be good for global commerce. Arctic ice is breaking up faster than scientists expected, which is going to open up new shipping routes, more oil and gas exploration, and even tourism. But Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports the U.S. may be missing the boat.
The Navy and Coast Guard battle the Arctic ice to supply the Far North Air Force installations. Led by the icebreaker West...
Back in the 50s, when that Coast Guard vessel was in service, nobody dreamed of a melting Arctic. But now...
You know, predictions are maybe somewhere in 30 years, it might be ice-free at least for part of the summer.
Ocean law expert David Vanderswag says that means more commerce at the top of the world. Some analysts say the race for Arctic resources is on. This week, the head of the Canadian Royal Navy called for a beefed-up military presence there. Meade Treadwell, Alaska's lieutenant governor, says America, on the other hand, it forgets it's an Arctic nation, too.
I was in the room with Vladimir Putin in September at a conference that he hosted in Arkhangelsk, Russia, where he announced construction of 9 new icebreakers. And then I found myself in a congressional hearing in Washington in December trying to scrape together the money for one.
The U.S. has only one working icebreaker right now, and at nearly $1 billion a boat, they're not high on Washington's to-do list. But Heather Conley, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, says what America really needs goes beyond big boats.
We really need a smart national economic strategy for the Arctic that balances the environment and the economic potential.
Conley says America's a superpower in every other place in the world, but in the Arctic right now, we're, quote, superpower light. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The prospect of lower corporate taxes did nothing at all for the mood on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Explicit in the tax plan that the White House rolled out today is the hope that changing things around is going to help the American manufacturing sector come back. Taxing this, not taxing that. Factories and their present condition have been much discussed on the primary campaign trail this year. Commentator Robert Reich says the discussion has been more fantasy, though, than reality.
With upcoming Republican primaries in Michigan and Ohio, Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum have plans to bring manufacturing back. Last month, President Obama announced a 6-point agenda to do the same. But despite all the campaign rhetoric, manufacturing will not be coming back. Pent-up demand for cars, appliances, and machinery has stoked a small resurgence, but the long-term trend in this country is fewer factory jobs. After World War II, 1 in 3 Americans was employed in manufacturing. Today, it's 1 in 8. Even if we didn't have to compete with lower-wage workers overseas, we'd still have fewer factory jobs. That's because the old assembly line has been replaced by computer-controlled machines and robots. Bringing back American manufacturing isn't the real challenge anyway. It's creating good jobs for the majority of Americans who lack 4-year college degrees. Manufacturing used to supply lots of these kinds of jobs because factory workers were represented by strong unions, powerful enough to get high wages. Not anymore. Even the once mighty United Auto Workers has been forced to accept pay packages for new hires of only $14 an hour. That's half what new hires got a decade ago, and about the same as most service sector workers now get. If there's a single reason for the decline of hourly wages over the last 3 decades, it's the weakening of unions. Membership has sunk from a third of private sector workers to fewer than 7%. But the presidential candidates aren't calling for stronger unions. Romney uses every opportunity to bash them, and Santorum is hardly enthusiastic. Even the president, though pro-union, has been noticeably silent on the labor struggles roiling the Midwest, including Indiana's so-called right-to-work law, intended to weaken unions. It's the first such law in the Midwest. American corporations are doing well again, but hourly wages continue to drop. The ratio of profits to wages is now higher than it's been since the government began keeping track. The fundamental problem isn't the decline of American manufacturing. It's the declining power of American workers to share in the productivity gains of the American economy.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Take a second. Let us know what you think, won't you? Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says contact. Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every 2 weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It's about the hidden side of everything. Dubner, good to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, Kai. And I got a question for you.
All right, shoot.
Are you pretty happy with your job these days?
Am I pretty happy? Most days, yeah.
Tell me this. What about your coworkers? How's their employee morale, would you say?
It depends on how heavy the beatings are. But no, actually, they're doing all right.
You know, workplace morale is something, especially in an economy like this, is something that's really worth thinking about. It translates directly into productivity. Low morale,
makes
bad
sense.
For the bottom line. Yeah. Good morale is kind of a tide that lifts all boats. Now, here's Michael Johnson, who studies organizational behavior at the University of Washington.
A lot of the current research on employee morale and managing people in general in organizations suggests that this may be the only remaining competitive advantage that organizations have. Organizations that do this well, they tend to do really well financially too.
But Kai, let me run an interesting wrinkle past you.
All right.
In a tough job market like this one, fewer people quit their jobs, less than 2 million a month now compared to more than 3 million before the recession, which means that more grumpy employees are staying put.
Right. So they're staying put because they're worried that they can't find another job.
Exactly.
Right?
Right. Yep.
How do you measure grumpiness?
Well, unfortunately, that's the problem. It's hard. A lot of firms do surveys, but personally, in my work that
Here's the thing. For HR managers everywhere, we all lie on those surveys.
Exactly. We lie on most surveys,
right.
But especially, you know, how happy are you? And I'm the person who pays you, and I need you to tell me how happy
exactly,
you are.
Exactly. That's right.
So sometimes you have to get creative. We actually put this question out to readers on our Freakonomics blog, and
okay.
We got some good answers. Here's Damon Bevan. He's a software engineer in Lexington, Kentucky. He used to visit lots of different companies. Here's how he sussed out worker morale in those places.
I look for the number of Dilbert comments, and that seemed to be inversely proportional to the level of morale. A lot of Dilbert comments seem to be like a passive-aggressive way of an employee complaining.
This is good. First of all, I love the Dilbert index, but also I love that we're crowdsourcing this segment now. That's awesome.
Of course. You know, yes. We've cut down here.
That's,
I don't know if you knew.
Right.
But,
that's right.
All right, try this one. This is from a management consultant named Tim Wadlow.
Okay.
He visited more than 100 manufacturing companies around the world. He came to believe that parking direction is an indicator of employee morale. Here's what Wadlow saw at the companies that had low morale.
A lot of these people seem very anxious to leave work, and often as they got to work, they would back their cars into their parking spot. And it seemed like maybe the moment they got to work, they were so dreading it that they were planning their escape.
I like that. That's great. Now, that doesn't apply here at Marketplace World Headquarters because our parking lot is mandated nose-in parking only.
That's the way to keep morale high,
force people
to park that
you
way.
You must stay at work. Okay, this is good anecdotal evidence, the key phrase being there, anecdotal, my friend.
Exactly. What you really want to know is you want to keep your eye on sick days, because calling in sick, especially when you're not sick, is kind of, you know, the ultimate expression of bad morale.
Well, yeah, but what, I mean, come on. HR is going to call everybody who calls in sick and says, I need a note from your doctor. What are we, 12?
Not going to happen, unfortunately. Michael Johnson, the UW professor we heard from earlier, he investigated a pair of auto parts plants that tried out a variety of incentives. Some were carrots, some were sticks. They wanted to cut down on absenteeism. He found that the combination of threat and reward actually worked very well, but he also found an interesting loophole, a little something we call the FMLA, or the Family Medical Leave Act.
Right.
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, you bet. It's the get time off to care for a sick, injured, whatever family member, yeah.
Exactly, the federal law. Now, when the company made it harder to call in sick the old way, some employees found a new way. Here's Michael Johnson.
Overall, absenteeism dropped about 4 to 4.5 days, But the absenteeism that was related to the FMLA went up about a day or day and a half over the year. So it seemed to us they might actually be gaming the system so that they could keep taking days off work and not suffer any punishment for it.
Right. So it took us a while to get there, but this is the hidden side, right? This is the unintended consequences of all that stuff.
That's exactly right. Right. And, you know, at the end of the day, isn't it nice to know that whenever you're feeling down and need a little me time, the federal government is there to give you a day off?
That's right. Stephen Dubner, freakonomics.com is the website. He's back in a couple of weeks. Talk to you later.
Thanks much, Guy.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Novo Nordisk. For nearly 90 years, committed to innovation in diabetes care. Learn more at novonordisk-us.com.
Coming up, life after high school.
I expected it to be an adventure. You got one shot at it, and you might as well make the most of it.
Ferris Bueller and the class of 1986. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrials fell 27 points today, gang. 0.2%, ended at 12,938. The NASDAQ off 15 points, 0.5%, 29.33 at the bell. The S&P 500. It edged down 4 points, 0.3%, 13.57. Citigroup and Morgan Stanley both cashed out more than 2.25%. Bank of America and Goldman Sachs each lost nearly 2%. Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan took off 1%. Garmin navigated up 9% on strong sales. They make GPS units. Intuit, the maker of TurboTax software, clicked up 6%. Netflix lost 4.25% on rumors that DirecTV will get into the video streaming biz. DirecTV beamed down 0.25%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note at exactly 2.0%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will be in London, her first stop on a tour that includes Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco. Do you feed our feathered friends in your own backyard, helping them make it through winter? Then you may already know that February is National Bird Feeding Month. And we watched her grow up from War of the Worlds to The Runaways. Actress Dakota Fanning turns 18. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so imagine in your mind's eye the prototypical tech company employee. A laptop in their shoulder bag, smartphone in hand, and a very cool bike underneath them. As the tech sector expands, biking to and at work is expanding right alongside. From the Transportation Nation Project, the WNYC, Andrea Bernstein reports.
On the Google campus in Mountain View, California, there's a strange kind of meeting space. It's a 7-person bicycle.
Everyone is pedaling simultaneously, but they're all facing each other.
Brendan Harrington runs transportation programs at Google.
Imagine one person facing forward and then the other 6 people around a circle. And the way the bike is manufactured and constructed, everyone can actually pedal at the same time, all contributing to propel the bike forward. But since they're facing each other, they can chat with one another, they can share ideas, they can have a team meeting if they'd like.
That's pretty much the way it is in the tech sector these days. Companies are in a race to outdo each other on bike friendliness. Google not only gives employees racks and lockers, the company will donate to charity if employees ride to work. Etsy's got an in-house bike mechanic. In New York, Foursquare just chose a new location for its headquarters based on where biking would be easy.
I never think of this as like going to work every day. It's just, hey, this is where I go to do the stuff that I like to do, and I ride my bike to get there.
When Foursquare CEO Dennis Crowley was raising money from venture capitalists, he pedaled to pitch meetings.
I might have got a couple weird looks when you walk in and your t-shirt's a little bit sweaty.
Crowley got the money and his company is wildly expanding. For him and other tech CEOs, not having a place to store bikes in the office would be like building a suburban campus without a parking lot.
It was not an option to be in a building where people would have to leave their bikes outside.
It's not just an amenity. For Foursquare and the other firms, having a bike-friendly culture spurs innovation.
We talk about Foursquare as being, as like creating software that helps change the way that people experience or even like use cities. And I think bikes do the same thing.
Biking has become the mode of choice for the educated high-tech worker.
Mitchell Moss runs a transportation think tank at New York University. He says the company that can get the most creativity and the most collaboration will win in the 21st century economy.
The modern office today is not really just a workplace. It's a play place. So, you know, if you go to Mozilla, they have pool tables.
At Foursquare, there's a ping pong table and a dartboard. But Crowley seems a little shocked to see, even in the brand new office, the bike rack is almost full.
I don't know. I'm actually sizing this up now and seeing, like, we're probably going to need a couple more racks. I don't know. I guess we could probably put some more around the corner if we needed to.
In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Yesterday on the broadcast, Adrienne Hill took us to Northbrook, Illinois, not far from Chicago. She took us in search of the past, in search of what happens to the expectations we had back in high school, in search of a guy named Ferris Bueller of the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And yes, we know it's make-believe, but we thought it might be interesting to see how Ferris's real-life high school has changed in the 25 years since that movie came out. Today, what happened to the class of 1986, the real-life classmates of Ferris Bueller? Here's Adrienne one more time.
We start this story with a roll call, perhaps the most famous roll call in movie history. Please cue Ben Stein.
Adams.
Here. I'm John Lovey. I'm a lawyer here in Chicago.
Adam Lee.
Here.
Dara Owen, and I'm a homemaker.
Adamowski.
My name is Josh Zaroff. I work for Empire Today, which sells carpet, and I work in the online division.
Adamson.
Here.
Nick Kokonis. I do a lot of different things. I've been sort of a serial entrepreneur for the last, 15, 20 years.
Nick's a wealthy former trader who now owns one of the toniest restaurants in Chicago. All four graduated from Glenbrook North High School in 1986. It's a public school in an upper middle class suburb of Chicago, and it's the set of some of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Josh and Nick both signed up to be extras in the movie.
When the movie was being made, casting folks came over to the high school. Yes, yes, no, no, yes, yes, yes. And I got a yes.
When they're asking for money for Ferris's kidney, you can see me very prominently.
Among the most important questions I have to ask these real-life classmates of Ferris, who was Bueller? Who was the uber-confident kid that everyone liked? Was there a Bueller?
Maybe Nick Kokonis. I hate to throw it on him, but he comes to mind.
That's civil rights attorney John Lovey. He and Nick hung out their senior year.
You know, when I think back of Nick, I see a guy sitting in class smiling, and he's the guy everybody knew was going to win the game of life, and he knew he was going to win the game of life.
I expected it to be an adventure. You got one shot at it, and you might as well make the most of it.
Have you had in your life some sort of Ferris Bueller day or moment where you're like, oh yeah?
Yeah, it's wrong to say, but I have lots of them. I've gotten over the last, 10 years an amazing number of opportunities to meet fantastic people who are great at what they do. I feel lucky all the time.
Of course, life for most of us isn't filled with days driving fast, flipping off the man, and doing whatever we want. Real life for all of us non-Ferrises can be tougher. Here's Josh and then Dara.
My previous company had huge layoffs, and myself and 10 other people were laid off in June. So I had the summer off, and it was probably one of the most nail-biting times in my life.
My husband's been out of work for the last, or almost a year. Are we feeling the pinch? Yes, but luckily we've been smart enough with our investments that we're not sitting here wondering if we're going to lose the house tomorrow, that kind of thing.
But for each of these class of 86 grads, buffered by a combination of education and wealth and hard work, life is going at least okay.
You know, I shouldn't say lucky, but very fortunate.
I feel really, really lucky. It wasn't easy at all.
It'll work out and it'll be great and wonderful. And
I'm very happy. I got a family that I like and likes me. I got a job that I like and that I'm pretty good at. So I feel very satisfied.
And as for the future of the country, the economy, and the outlook for their kids?
The problem in America right now is like a PR problem with ourselves. Economic cycles, every one of them seems like the worst or the best that's ever happened because they're happening to us and our generation. And, you know, I'm not minimizing the issues, you know, globally or in the U.S., but at the same time, like, humanity's been going at this for tens of thousands of years. We keep pushing forward. And so I think my kids will have opportunities that I never even dreamed of.
I'm hoping that by the time that our kids are in high school, that everything will have, I don't want to say fixed itself, but would have turned itself around.
I think that as long as they know what I know now, which is if I want something, that I'm going to have to make it happen and it's not going to happen by itself, I think they'll do great.
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the craze for Greek yogurt may finally have jumped the shark. As an aside, by the way, what is it about Greek yogurt that's got everybody all crazy for it? Anyway, all right, I digress. Ben and Jerry said today it's coming out with four flavors of Greek yogurt: strawberry shortcake, raspberry fudge chunk, banana peanut butter, and blueberry vanilla graham, which, if you ask me, kind of goes against the natural goodness of the stuff, doesn't it? $4.39 a pint while supplies last. All right, we got to go. Come on, $4.39 a pint? That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 27 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ off 15 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 down 4 points, 0.3%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard. Engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for more of the same tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.